You're listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Hello, this is Rabble Radio, recorded on Friday, June 19th, 2026. I'm your host, Nick Seabrook. Rabble.ca shares the news of the day through a progressive lens. If you're curious about what's happening in Canadian politics, labor, the environment, and beyond, you've come to the right place. This is news for the rest of us. Thanks for tuning in. This week on the show, we are sharing a re-released episode from our archives as a part of Rabble's summer series, celebrating 25 years of Rabble.ca. This time, an episode from November 2009. In this episode, we revisit a conversation originally broadcast by Red Eye, the long-running progressive podcast that was a staple of Rabble's podcast network. The interview features David Eby, then the executive director of the BC Civil Liberties Association, and now the Premier of British Columbia, discussing the province's controversial plans to displace Vancouver's unhoused population ahead of the 2010 Winter Olympics in Vancouver. As Vancouver takes to the global stage once again, this time for the FIFA World Cup, looking back at Eby's sharp critiques of state displacement feels incredibly informative and perhaps a little hypocritical. We also look back at a vital conversation for Pride Month. Megan Perry speaks with Arthur Kizanyi about the legislative landscape for queer people in Uganda. Unfortunately, in the years since this interview first aired, Uganda has passed even harsher laws, making it one of the most dangerous places in the world to be queer. It is a reminder of how much is at stake and how the fight for queer liberation continues. From November 2009, here are those conversations. Take a listen.
David Eby is the executive director of the BC Civil Liberties Association. He spoke to the Rabble Podcast Network's Red Eye about the leaked documents.
Now, I understand that your organization has come across some new government strategies to deal with homelessness during the Olympics. What is the most recent plan?
Well, that's a great question. We don't really know. We uncovered some memos from a source from inside the housing ministry at the provincial level that indicated bureaucrats were working on a draft piece of legislation called the Assistance to Shelter Act. Now, this act would essentially create a regime where a police officer seeing someone who's homeless on the street could say, please report to the nearest housing shelter, there's extreme weather, and if the person refused, the police officer could call, get an administrative certificate, and take the person to the shelter, and if they still refuse to go into the shelter, take them to jail, and release them into cells where they'd be held until the so-called extreme weather event was over.
So this would be done against their will, even if they didn't want to go to a homeless shelter?
Yeah, the memos expressly outline that force could be used in effecting the arrest of the homeless person and that they could be held in cells against their will. Now, the important thing to note about, because it sounds kind of, you know, well, what's the problem with that? There were 37 extreme weather days last winter, and extreme weather in Vancouver traditionally has been defined as 3 days or more of rain in a row. So if you're thinking about the Winter Olympics, think about February in Vancouver, I mean, that's a pretty rainy month, and it could mean the homeless being detained for a significant portion of the month.
Now, how did you discover these plans? Did the government make some sort of announcements?
No, they were leaked to us from a source.
I see, okay. Now, the words assist and protect are used in these documents. Is there really any intent here to protect homeless people?
Well, I mean, this is just it. It sounds great, and the minister is saying things like, oh, you know, I'd love to save lives, but these people who insist on rights are preventing me from saving the lives that I really desperately want to save. The issue is that when you force people into shelters, they're going to hide from outreach workers, they're going to hide from police officers They're going to hide from members of the public, and these are the people who intervene when they're in medical distress. So if you're hiding under a stairwell where no one can see you and you're dying, no one's going to call 911 to help you out. And in addition, if the minister were truly concerned about the fact that people were dying in the streets, you'd think maybe he'd open enough shelter spaces to serve the homeless population that we have across the province. There are many cities that don't have any homeless shelters at all, despite the fact that they have significant homeless populations. And in Vancouver, we've got far more than 1,500 homeless people in our last homeless count. But even in the worst weather we have, we only have 1,300 shelter spaces.
And have there been any plans to increase the number of shelters?
Not that I know of. In fact, the minister actively intervened to close two of the heat shelters this winter after neighbors around it said they were tired of seeing the people who were using the shelter, or they said were using the shelter, using drugs in their neighborhood. They felt that it was an inappropriate neighborhood for there to be a shelter and marginalized people nearby. And so the minister actually personally intervened and shut down those two shelters. So he's actually shutting down shelters at a time when he says he's so concerned about saving lives during extreme weather.
Well, after taking people off the street and there's no new shelter space, where are they going to put them?
Well, that's a great question, too, because a lot of people are doing the math, and if you've got 300 more, because it's about 1,597, let's just take the lowest possible count, which is the homeless count from last winter. If you've got 300 too few shelter spaces, there's not even enough space in jail for 300 people. So if you arrested all of these people and took them to jail, there wouldn't be space, so there would have to be some kind of temporary facility set up. And, you know, it gets very easy to become very conspiratorial about these plans when you look at other Olympic cities and what they've done. And for people to say, you know, that's crazy, that would never happen here. And, you know, I was one of those people. Like, 2 years ago, I was filmed for an Olympic documentary that someone was doing and that Conrad Schmidt was doing. And I said, there's no way that people in Vancouver would put up with homeless people being arrested, taken off to jail. But, man, the provincial government's really made a believer out of me with the so-called Assistance to Shelter Act.
And how did the government respond to these revelations?
Well, the housing minister confirmed them all for Frances Bueller in the Globe and Mail. We provided her with copies of the documents, and she called the minister, and he said, yep, that's the plan. It's worth a try. You know, people are going to make complaints about rights, but we need to do this to save lives. By the end of the day, on Monday, after that paper came out, he was telling CBC that, oh, there was never any plan to arrest people. There was no movement to put people into jail, despite the fact that that was the very clear wording of the memos that he had confirmed for the Globe and Mail just the day before. So there was a huge outcry, both, I imagine, within his government from the lawyers who looked at the plan and said there's not a chance it's constitutional, but also in the media. And there was no backup from either the police, which was notable, or from the homeless service providers to say, hey, this is a great idea. This is really going to help the homeless. This is what we need. Nobody backed the minister up on it, and I think that's one of the reasons why he started making these comments. But we're still staying tuned because the minister, despite saying there's no movement afoot to arrest people, has said that he is proceeding with this legislation, and it's going to be introduced in this session in the provincial legislature. So we're waiting very keenly to see what the wording is.
Now, there's still no bylaw, as far as I understand. There's still no bylaw against sitting or sleeping on the sidewalk in Vancouver. Is that right?
That is correct. Actually, technically in Vancouver, as long as you're sleeping on a sidewalk and not blocking pedestrian traffic and you're on the public property, you're allowed to do that. But the reality, as we all know, we've all seen the downtown ambassadors, we've all seen the police moving homeless people along. I've watched regularly while police officers move people along who are sleeping on sidewalks in Gastown, for example. It's functionally illegal to sleep on a sidewalk in Vancouver, even though it's technically illegal under our bylaws.
Well, this most recent proposal has blown up in the face of the Liberals. What can we expect from them in the future, David?
Well, you know, I hope that it's enough to really kill the plan to force people, to take the homeless to jail, basically, or to turn our shelters into jails. But what we need to look for is the introduction of this legislature and whether the uproar that came from this initial round is enough to kill the plan entirely, or whether they're just going to massage it a little bit before it's introduced in the legislature. So we'll be watching for that. And anyone who's interested in the legal observer training, we have the training coming up on October 22nd at Britannia. It's in the Canucks Community Education, Canucks Family Education Center, and everybody's welcome.
Thanks for taking the time to talk with us today, David.
Thanks, it's my pleasure.
That was David Eby speaking about the new rules that are in the works to keep the homeless off the streets during the Vancouver Olympics.
Arthur Kisenyi is a young Ugandan actor. Last week, he traveled to Canada to perform in the Canadian premiere of a work called Strange News. In Kisenyi's home country of Uganda, activists are calling for action from the international community. They're trying to prevent the Ugandan parliament from passing a very strict anti-homosexuality bill. Punishments under the new bill range from 3 years in prison for not informing the authorities that someone is gay, to forced HIV testing, to the death penalty for gay sex where one or both partners has HIV. Twitter feeds from gay Ugandans include statements like this one. Sometimes life as a gay Ugandan is nothing more than juggling risk. Frank Mugisha is with Sexual Minorities Uganda, a coalition of three organizations supporting the GLBT community there. I spoke to him via Skype about what the law will mean for Ugandans and what Canadians can do to help.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. How are you?
I'm great. How are you?
I'm well. Could you tell us a little bit about what's in the bill that's being passed right now in Uganda?
All right. This anti-homosexual bill was introduced by a honorable member of parliament called David Bahati, and it has had a lot of backing by the religious right and anti-gay group. This bill is basically about anything to do with homosexuality becoming illegal in Uganda. This bill criminalizes any person who talks about homosexuality, any NGO, any non-government organization or civil society that works with homosexuality, any donor that funds homosexuality. It introduces new laws like the death penalty for people engaged in homosexuality. It introduces laws like criminalization of parents, people in authority who do not report homosexuals. For example, if you have a gay son, if you have a lesbian son, and you don't report them to the authority, it makes you a criminal. As a punishment under this law, A, it could be life imprisonment. B, it could be a death penalty.
So very serious.
Yeah, it is very serious. It is a very, very serious law. That's why we're trying our best to stop this law.
And what kind of reaction has there been in the press and in the public? I know there's a tabloid called Red Pepper there, and they published a list of names of people that they said were homosexuals. What's the reaction been like from the public?
Because there is a lot. In Uganda, there's a lot of religious propaganda and hatred. These groups, the religious groups, have gone around the whole nation spreading their propaganda that homosexuality is an Western agenda. Homosexuality is going to end the family values in Uganda. Homosexuality is here to stop the normal heteronormative way of living, which they believe in. And they say it has an agenda of recruiting younger children into homosexuality. They don't believe it is a sexual orientation that someone can be born with. They say it is something people are learning and are bringing in Uganda. So they have called upon the Ugandan society, the whole Uganda, to come up and fight homosexuality. So the atmosphere out there is so bad that people hate homosexuals. So they're advocating, actually they are pushing for this law to be passed. When it all started, the Cassowite and the anti-gay groups moved around Uganda collecting signatures or put saying on a petition for a stronger law. And people signed this petition calling for a stronger law on homosexuality in Uganda. Because of the propaganda that has been spread in them that homosexuality is about ending the normal, which the family values which they call normal. They say homosexuality is about recruiting children. So people have accepted and they have listened to what the religious people have been saying. Therefore, the society is very homophobic out there and they really are in body.
What is the gay and lesbian community doing to change people's minds in the other direction? What kind of work is being done there now?
Our work right now is very, 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 very tough, I would say, because we have got to do a lot. The biggest percentage of Uganda is Christian. So we have got a lot of Christians in Uganda. And the religious leaders have phoned the Ugandan people right for sowing their seed of the propaganda against homosexuality. Our work is very tough right now to try and change the minds of these people and tell them, I mean, we are like you, we are like any other person. We are your own children. Why are you trying to kill us? Why are you stigmatizing us? Why are you doing all these things to us? Even when you do a small campaign, these big groups, these big religious groups come up with huge and bigger campaigns. They wishwash us. So it's very difficult. So what we've done, we are now engaging with the legislators themselves. They don't pass this law. And what we're doing is try to give them the implications of this law. That this law is not all about a particular group of minorities, but this law could touch anyone at some moment. Because this law is going to criminalize even anyone in authority. Civil society and non-government organizations in Uganda, they have seen the implications of this bill. They have seen the implications of this law if it is made law. It's going to even stop donor funding coming into Uganda, meaning if a donor is giving money to HIV-AIDS here in Uganda and also funding men who have sex with men and HIV-AIDS, is going to be stopped from giving that money, which is so ambiguous. And I mean, who would want to do that? So civil society has also teamed up with us to try and inform Parliament and inform members of Parliament that this law you're trying to pass in Uganda, if it becomes law, it is going to make life very, very difficult for ordinary Ugandans. Non-government organizations working with sexual minorities and also working on issues of HIV/AIDS, but including men who have sex with men. So we're trying to pass out this information to as many people as possible so that they do not make this law in Uganda.
How do you pass out that information in such a hostile environment?
What we have done right now, we are sending out press statements, we are sending out letters to people in authority, and of course we have also tried to request the parliamentary committee that is holding this bill, because this bill is about us, and this bill is, according to the Constitution of Uganda, the public is entitled to go and present their case to this parliamentary committee and ask them, we want you to listen to us and listen to our views.
Do you think that's likely?
Yeah, we think it's likely. They will. Because we put a lot of pressure. It is in the media, it is on record everywhere that there is a bill coming up in Uganda. So they will. Because according to the position of Uganda, they are supposed, mm-hmm. according to the position of Uganda, they are supposed to meet us. They are supposed to meet every person from the public who has the interest in this bill, who wants to put an input in this bill. They have met with the religious group. So they are obligated, as citizens of Uganda, we are obligated to discuss this bill and to meet them and tell them the implications in this bill. You can show them the insight, the dangers and of this new law. And they will. Yeah, they will listen. And I hope when they listen, they also act on the issues we inform them and they stop this law.
And what are you hearing from members of the gay and lesbian community there? As this is, you know, this bill is in the media, what's changing in their lives, their day-to-day lives?
Uganda has got a lot of ignorant people. People are not aware. They think this is law already. If this is a bill that has got to go through processes before it is made law, it has got to go through parliament, different channels before it is made law. The president has to sign on it before it is made law. But then the fact that we are talking about it every day in the media, so people think that this is already a law around homosexuality, and they're very worried, they're very scared. They think now Uganda has come a place that a homosexual cannot live. So then we are doing our best to see that this bill is not passed, this bill is not made law. We're doing everything that the Constitution of Uganda allows us to do to try and stop this bill from being made law.
Okay. And what about people in the international community who want to support you and work towards social justice in Uganda? What do you ask people to do?
The international community has been very, very, very helpful in this struggle. And then we still call upon the international community to continue supporting. For example, recently we released, Sexual Minority Uganda released an action alert calling upon the international community to demonstrate on the 9th of November at the Ugandan diplomatic missions and ask them to send information back home and tell the legislators, please do not pass this law. Do not make this law. It is unnecessary. It is not wanted because it is unconstitutional and it abuses all the basic human rights of a human being in Uganda. So we are calling upon all the our supporters, our allies, to demonstrate on that day, on the 9th of November, at the diplomatic missions of Uganda, and ask them politely, do not pass this law. Politely, do not have an anti-homosexuality law in Uganda, because it is going to put Uganda backwards. And this, Uganda has been moving forward in terms of HIV AIDS, in terms of non-governmental organizations, in terms of policies that this law is going to put back Uganda in that picture. So we are calling upon our international allies to ask the diplomatic missions to send word back home and tell our legislators not to make this law.
Okay, so November 9th at the diplomatic missions.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you for talking to me today.
You're welcome.
That was Frank Mugisha, the chairperson of Sexual Minorities Uganda.
That was a clip from our 94th episode of Rabble Radio called Choose Activism. To listen to the full original program, visit the link in the show notes of this episode. And now, this is our In Case You Missed It segment, where we review the top stories from the week on Rabble.ca. Let's jump right in. Starting this week in world news, Rainbow Railroad is an organization dedicated to supporting 2S LGBTQIA+ refugees. They say they are experiencing a growing demand on their services at a time of a global reduction in funding. Rainbow Railroad received over 20,000 requests for assistance in 2025, a 51% increase from the year before. The country from which Rainbow Railroad received the most requests was the United States, followed by Uganda. Meanwhile, governments like the US, the UK, and Canada have all taken steps to reduce the amount of funding they give to support refugees around the world. The demand for support for refugees continues to grow as the 2S LGBTQIA+ community experiences discrimination, both state-sponsored and otherwise, in countries like Uganda, Afghanistan, and of course, the US. Not only has Canada reduced the amount of funding it provides to refugees and other humanitarian causes, it has also placed greater restrictions on those seeking asylum and refugee status in the country. Bill C-12 was passed earlier this year and requires those seeking asylum to do so within 1 year or be disqualified. Devin Matthews, Rainbow Railroad's chief programs officer, explained why Bill C-12 put 2S LGBTQIA+ refugees at greater risk.
For a number of reasons, this is really concerning for LGBTQI people. Many individuals don't actually know that they can claim asylum on the basis of their sexual orientation or gender identity, given the extreme persecution they've experienced at home. Many individuals don't have a firm understanding of their own sexual orientation or gender identity, despite knowing that they're queer when they arrive in Canada, and they may take a minute to understand how to identify that or relate to that. Some are in domestic settings where it's not safe for them to come out or claim asylum. Some don't have access to proper legal support in order to make that asylum claim. And then some also actually return home in an effort to make being at home work and then have to come back to Canada because their life is threatened after their first entry point.
June, of course, is Pride Month. Rainbow Railroad is a registered charity, always looking for more donations and volunteers to help support the important work that it does. As well, they are calling on members of the public to reach out to their elected officials and express their concerns with Bill C-12. In national news this week, Prime Minister Mark Carney quietly killed the Office of the Canadian Ombudsperson for Responsible Enterprise. Created by former Prime Minister Justin Trudeau in 2019, the Canadian Ombudsperson for Responsible Enterprise, or CORE, was responsible for investigating complaints from members of the public against corporations operating in Canada and around the world. In 2024, the first person to be in charge of this new office stepped down and was not immediately replaced. The department had already been chronically underfunded up to this point and did not have the power to issue sanctions against companies that violated laws or regulations. Last week, Carney announced that the department would be closed altogether because it was, quote, inefficient. Carney did not announce any sort of replacement for Core, leaving those experiencing exploitation by Canadian companies without support. Also this week, June is Indigenous History Month, and Rabble has a selection of 8 films by Indigenous artists for you to check out. From the historical docudrama Bones to the comedy of the incredible 25th year of Mitzi Bearclaw to the horror of Blood Quantum, there is a great range of Indigenous films brought to life by Indigenous actors and artists to be enjoyed. Check out rabble.ca today to read the full list of our recommendations. In animal rights news, a recent court decision will make it harder for members of the public to hold factory farms accountable. Some factory farms are notorious for their treatment of animals. Livestock like pigs, chickens, or cows are often held in unsanitary conditions, eating unhealthy food, and kept in tight spaces where they can hardly move. These cases of abuse have often come to light thanks to the work of brave members of the public who have gone undercover inside these facilities to expose these cruel conditions. A decision by the Ontario Court of Appeal found that undercover investigations are not protected under the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. This decision means that factory farms can sue journalists and other members of the public who go undercover to film conditions at their facilities for things like making false statements in order to gain access to the facilities. Such a decision will have wide-reaching consequences for other types of undercover journalistic investigations. And finally, in a column on Rabble, Lois Ross writes about the opposition to the Alto High-Speed Rail project. The project would see brand new high-speed rail train lines built from Quebec City to Toronto with stops across eastern Ontario along the way. The project will require the confiscation of private land, including farmland, in order to build the new train track. Organizations like the National Farmers Union and the Union des Producteurs Agricoles du Québec have expressed their opposition to the project. They have raised concerns related to the project's feasibility, as well as what they say has been a lack of appropriate public consultation. Both organizations note that they are not opposed to a high-speed rail project, but they are opposed to this project and how it's being managed. As always, you can read the full versions of all the stories we talked about today on rabble.ca. And that's it for Rabble this week. Thanks so much for listening. To help support our show further, consider subscribing to Rabble Radio on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube. You can also choose to subscribe to us over on Patreon for special bonus content for Rabble Radio. If you're already subscribed, consider making a donation to rabble.ca at rabble.ca/donate. Thank you to all of the journalists and writers who contributed to this week's content on rabble.ca, and thank you to Carl Nuremberg for supplying the music for this episode. I'm Nick Seabrook, and we'll talk to you next time.